Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
What is up, Ivy Podcast listeners? I am so glad to be able to have some time with you today. I am your host for today's podcast episode, Angela Alberti, sitting with a very good friend and someone that I know will provide a lot of leverage and insight when it comes to fintech, the world of staffing, and the recruitment involved in this very interesting and highly growing segment of blockchain technology. Michael Yockend is going to be joining us today. A quick reminder for all of our listeners, if you have a chance, go ahead and give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know what you think of the Ivy Podcast when you are in your app store. We appreciate all the feedback, but it really helps us gain more listeners like yourself that dedicate some time to listen in on these episodes. But that was the only opening statement I wanted to begin with, along with my excitement to be able to have the chance to interview Michael. Mike, give us a quick rundown on yourself.
Angela, thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to be on. Rundown of myself, a little bit of bio. I've been in the industry for 10 years now. Started with Kforce, was a recruiter. Moved up to director when I worked at Dysys, and now I started my own firm going on over 3 years now. So
awesome. So Technical Paradigm, that is the firm that you have started. Tell us a little bit about the career that has led you up until that point and leads you now into the position as entrepreneur, and how y'all have really found your niche within fintech and blockchain technology.
Yeah. So, as I said, you know, I worked as a recruiter for a long time. A little bit of my background recruiting is I was, like most people, when I was working at a big box firm, I was generalist IT recruiter, right? I really, in my personal life, got into blockchain circa 2014-2015. I translated that into my work. Was able to staff the first commercial blockchain transaction, saw a need in the market for that, right? And built my firm around that. And a lot of the contacts that I made through the years became my clients. So
that is pretty awesome, because I think it really at least gives the audience and myself a chance to understand that you were part of the team that helped staff the first blockchain transaction. That's an amazing feat, but it's also kind of what has led to the success that you guys have had. And I'm sure that you've witnessed within the last decade or so how the IT talent industry has evolved, particularly for one of the fastest growing segments within it, which is fintech. So give us a little bit of insight of what that experience has been like. And to add to that, where do you feel like it's not just been the last 10 years, but where it's going in the next 10 years?
Yeah. So when I said first blockchain transaction, I meant first commercial institutionalized one, right? There was blockchain transactions going on. I don't know if you know the famous story of like the guy who bought pizza for like, you know, about like 10 Bitcoin or whatever, and it would be worth like crazy amount of money right now. But when I was first starting out, there was no recruiting for blockchain talent. It was really like it was a little bit like tied to politics back then, right? So we were looking for like people that were like into decentralization. A lot of them had like Ron Paul following, like, you know, libertarian beliefs, right? So we were trying to tie that into the technical scope of what was needed. That's completely changed. And especially in the last 5 years, there's been boot camps that have popped up that are just teaching blockchain and Ethereum development, right? What's happening right now as we speak is universities are starting to teach it. So your question is where it's going in the next 10 years. Right.
Right.
And I think that, if you remember what happened in 2008, the financial collapse, that's right when we started seeing things like PayPal pop off. Right. Mm-hmm. That was kind of like the first disturbance in the traditional financial markets. Right. COVID, kind of accelerated what we call DeFi, decentralized finance, to a point that even a year and a half ago before COVID, or maybe COVID's been around now for like 2 years, I didn't think it would be as fast growing as it is, right? But now in this space, it's getting to the point where everything you could do in traditional finance and traditional banking, you could do in decentralized banking in the DeFi space using blockchain technology.
Wow.
So, yeah, yeah.
So it's definitely immersing itself into different areas of what is our everyday walks of life. So this process that you guys have developed, and it's pretty interesting to me because I'm so outside of the fintech space. I'm the outsider looking in and just kind of in awe of the evolvement and the development of how quickly this segment of an industry is growing and the workforce needed to supply it. So let's talk a little bit about that and how technical paradigm has really been able to convert itself into this go-to agency resource when it comes to blockchain-oriented fintech. It's more so of how did you guys do that?
Yeah, yeah. So I got lucky, right? There was a market need, especially here in Chicago, and mm-hmm. not to bash on other tech hub centers, but traditional finance, like in New York, didn't accept early crypto, right? Chicago did with open arms.
Wow.
So like if you ever heard of the Blockchain Alliance, that's here in Chicago, right?
I see.
So I was at the right place in the right time, right? Mm-hmm. We were able to capitalize on the contacts that I made working on that large transaction that I talked about. And all those people, they went and started their own startups, which if you know anything about blockchain, it could be used for, like Ethereum, for example, you could use smart contracts for anything, right? You could use it for mortgages, you could use it for insurance, you could use it across the line. So we became, for my clients, the people to go to, but the word of mouth is really what spread for us, right? As soon as we got in and we were able to prove ourselves that we could staff and we had this network that, you know, the big box firms didn't have, it really got us into all these different companies, which lucky for us, grew while we've been growing a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fintechs exploded, especially the decentralized finance in the blockchain space within the last 3 years. So we were involved in that directly. Most recently, you know, NFTs, non-fungible tokens.
Non-fungible tokens. Yes, I do know that. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Most recently. So because we're already in the space, because we already have the talent, a lot of these are based on the Ethereum blockchain. We're the go-to agency for that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this big boom, happened for us as well, you know?
Right place, right time, being one of the pioneers within the industry and then evolving yourself to be able to tap into the startup nature of what has been this rapidly growing segment. So that is pretty awesome. What I think is also amazing about your model, and we see this happening because staffing and recruiting is going to have to evolve itself just as the industries around them are evolving, especially in this area of fintech, right?
Yeah.
And you guys have developed this basic principle behind the RAS model. And there could be some people that are listening in today and saying, what the hell is RAS? So give us a breakdown on what RAS is. I think about it as something comparative to an RPO model, recruitment process outsourcing model. What are the differentiators when it comes to RAS and how has it helped you guys when it comes to the startup companies that y'all service?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some similarities, definitely, right? And with RPOs, at least with my experience in the big box firms, a lot of it working with Fortune Fives. As you mentioned, we are startup, evangelical startup, like believers, right?
Right.
And with that, easier adoption, much more transparency. The startup can hone in right away. We can come in. We give them set pricing from the beginning, right? What we have similar to the RPO space is we kind of come in and replace a lot of the recruitment that's being done. They don't need IT recruiters, right? Something that we have a little bit, I think, in my opinion, different is on my team, we have a lot of developers and architects, which give advice to our clients. So go on site, might be able to tell them, hey, this is a better technology to use, right? This is the experience we have using this technology. This is the experience we have. If you give us your budget, we could tell you how to best maximize that budget. So kind of a more intimate relationship, in my opinion, especially with a startup that's growing as we're growing, you know? So
that's interesting. So recruiting as a service, and it goes,
It's a gimmicky word, right? I'm using,
I love it. I think it's great.
Yeah. Software as a service. I was like, I might as well, you know,
yeah. Since we're recruiting as a service, and it just taps into that on-demand, easily adoptable, very transparent nature of the model when compared to the RPO, which, as we know, can take months for implementation and adoption and adaptation.
A lot of bureaucracy.
There certainly is. All righty. So now going on this a little bit further, is when it comes to onshore, offshore, nearshore staffing, can you give us a breakdown of what each of these segments mean and really how they've helped you and your general opinion on utilizing offshore or nearshore or even keeping things onshore? What are your thoughts around this?
Yeah. So we nearshore, I don't know much about, right? I know that it's Mexico, Brazil, South, Central America, right? So it definitely has its advantages, especially when it comes to time zones and some cultural advantages, right? In my opinion, I could see that. I am biased and I think our model is the best model. We have our own offshore team. And let's say a company signs up with us with recruiting as a service, right? They want to do some kind of front-end development, right? We'll have like a JavaScript guy come in, HTML, JS, right? Do like a quick front page aesthetics, UX, UI, something like that, right? I would not recommend my clients to 100% offshore any of their projects. I think that it's a good add-on service. And that's the way we use it. Yeah. So we have developers on our team. They're able to utilize them at any time. They don't have to hire anybody even on a contract on there. So we just come in, we fill it out, it's done, and they don't have to think about it anymore. Proven talent too.
I gotcha. So that is good to know. And I think in our particular industry, you know, the offshore segment, and I love how you said it, you kept it pretty transparent. It's not an all-in-one solution if you are thinking of completely outsourcing on an offshore basis. It should be more so utilized and understood as a complement to something happening internally. There has been some notoriety when it comes to utilizing an offshore segment. Why do you think that is? And what are some of the red flags or some of the working experiences that we should look out for when it comes to offshore utilization?
Yeah, I think it gets a bad name a lot because of what you just said. I think that when people completely offshore their whole model and all of their IT practices, it's really, really, really hard for business and IT to correlate on whatever they're doing. You know, it's even harder in the United States if business and IT is in the same organization for them to agree with, right? Can you imagine if the whole IT department, our IT is done in Ukraine, right? If the IT department's offshore to Ukraine, and then you got all your business heads in Chicago, right? So the way it's used for us, and I think that it would be better utilized in the market as if you have maybe your architects, your project managers sit here in the States, right? Kind of the decision makers, the figureheads, the people that are talking to the stakeholders, right? Mm-hmm. And then no offense to my developer friends out there, but any of like your front end developers, your foot soldiers, you get them out in offshore, they're able to add on and create a better service, more synergy, cheaper, and they're able to work when your Americans are sleeping, right? Because of the time difference. So it's done by the morning.
That's awesome. That's pretty great. Okay, so now I want to just shift into another area. And this is more so of an opinion piece because, we're not just business colleagues. We follow each other on LinkedIn and we've been friends for some time. I really like and appreciate a lot of the things that your company and yourself are putting out there on a LinkedIn platform. And there was one of the things that I think you've recently, or maybe it wasn't recently, but it was some time where you published when it came to IT foreign talent. So what are some steps needed to better engage foreign IT talent for companies and the government body that regulates the process? Because you guys are in a highly competitive market and there's not even enough supply to meet the demand. So you, at some point, you have to leverage IT foreign talent. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, look, everyone gets mad about our clients hiring H1 talent. Our clients would hire all Americans if they could. They don't exist, right? Mm-hmm. Look at Elon Musk. Look at the co-founder of Google. You have a lot of foreign talent that comes in here and just dominates. And the reason being, and I don't want to bash your education system because we could go on for hours about this, but I think the mentality is a little bit different, right? Me speaking as an Eastern European, I have a lot of Indian employees. I also have a lot of Indian clients and I place a lot of, and there's a lot of Asian and Indian people involved in IT, right? So a lot of the mentality I think is similar to what we have with our Eastern European mentality. And the reason we get into STEM is we see it as the quickest way for a buck, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of American kids that I grew up with, their parents are, whatever makes you happy, son. Right. Mm-hmm. And you grow up and I know a lot of people that grew up and wanted to become lawyers. It's a sexy job. Right. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the average salary in Chicago, at least of a lawyer compared to the average salary of an IT recruiter and then the average salary of a developer, IT recruiter, then developer, lawyers, actually the out of the three is making the least. Right.
Isn't that amazing? That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Out of the three has by far the most schooling because developer, you could do an 8-week boot camp, right? Mm-hmm. I think that it's not necessarily the sexiest thing to sit behind a computer for 8 hours a day, right? Mm-hmm. But if we put a focus on STEM, we were to graduate more kids into the engineering field, we wouldn't need to use H1 talent, right? Mm-hmm. However, India is doing that. The reason you see a lot of Eastern Europeans involved with it is because during the Cold War commie days, we were pushing STEM because we were trying to beat America. Well, not we, I'm an American, but mm-hmm. My family was telling me that science and electronics and IT was pushed on them at an early age. So they came over here and they did what they knew. And a lot of them are involved in software engineering now because they saw it as the quickest way to make a buck. And you don't see a lot of Russian lawyers or, even Russian psychiatrists, right? Because mm-hmm. All of that schooling is not, they're not going to come here and do all that schooling and wait until they could finally make that buck. They could see the dollar bills in front of them being an IT architect by a quick path into it, right? As soon as they get into this country, use their IT knowledge and move up the corporate ladder.
That's right. And, you know, when you guys have to, and as you said, there's simply certain roles that you cannot find an American worker for, and you have to rely on an H-1B. Usually that engagement requires, you know, agencies or staffing or people in talent to sub these out to those that actually hold the sponsorship for that type of talent. And we can get into this for hours, but what are some of the tips that you guys have utilized and learned from when partnering with agencies that hold that sponsorship for these type of workers?
You got to be careful. Right. You got to vet them.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of times I hate to bash on my own country, for example, but I think when you're dealing with a country like Ukraine, there isn't the kind of infrastructure you have in place here as the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And with the lack of infrastructure comes people willing to kind of bend the rules, right? You get duplicate resumes, you get people who are faking resumes, right? I hear the same about other countries as well, where you get H-1s from as well. And it happened to us. We got kicked out of, I think I've told you before, we got kicked out of one of our clients. And that's when I learned, hey, we are only going to be working with specific vendors. I told my recruiters, like, they have to be approved. And that's the only kind of vendors we're working with. To answer your question, vet these people, make sure that you're working with people that you trust. And also the screening process has to be more. It can't just be, you know, I have a problem already with the way a lot of IT recruitment firms screen. I don't think that you could just do a phone screen and send it to your client. Mm-hmm. We do like coding challenges, but we add an extra layer to that as well. We do video coding challenges to make sure it's the same person who's doing the coding challenge on video as is going to be showing up for the first day. And then we get their IDs and we make sure, and then we send that to our client so that when the person shows up on their first day, it matches up with the person who was doing the video that we sent over to our client for the coding challenge.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing that you guys have had to mitigate problems with false resumes or the incorrect person on the interview versus the candidate that actually shows up.
Makes us look horrible too, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I've heard some of those. That's really scratching the surface on some of the things that I've heard. And you know, the H-1B process is lengthy. It's highly regulated. It's absolutely needed, especially considering the demand that we have and simply the work that's not being able to fulfill that process. But it's interesting to also hear the experience of some of the sponsorships that have happened when it comes to these type of workers. And now I want to shift over into one of my last questions for today, because we are coming up on time here. But when it comes to top retainment tips for a highly competitive industry like IT, like the fintech sector for IT, when you are dealing with candidates and a market that has a nearly 0% unemployment rate, what are some of those retainment tips that you guys, because at the end of the day, like you said, you have those experts in-house, you guys are consulting to the clients. What do you guys consult it when it comes to retaining top talent within IT?
Yeah, so my answer for this is kind of going to be a little bit opposite of my answer with why H-1s come over here, right? Mm-hmm. And why I think that like Eastern Europeans excel at IT. Mm-hmm. I think to get the top talent, to get people with fintechs to want to stick and stay at your company, you got to get more than just the dollar bill. A lot of these kids, they grew up like hacking their iPhones, right? Jailbreaking their iPhones. Like, they love technology and they want to work with the latest and greatest. So you got to sell them on that. Mm-hmm. You could change the world with tech, and you are changing the world with tech with fintechs right now. So attract them with that. Don't try to attract them with having like a beer cart, right? And like, you know, foosball table. attract them with saying, hey, man, you're going to be working on the most cutting edge tools, and you're going to be defining the future, because that's what they want to be. That's why they are involved with this. And that's the best kind of candidate, the candidate that wants to be involved in the industry because they're going to be changing the world.
Okay.
Through their work.
And I love that, because it's totally in line with a lot of the generational impact that we foresee happening. Millennials and Gen Zers are now the largest segment of the workforce, with the exodus of what has been the boomer and now, you know, Generation X, definitely not at retirement age, but no longer the majority of the workforce. There's a lot of the things that this generation, this newer generation, values that have been so non-traditional, from what we've grown accustomed to, things like purposeful work, of knowing and feeling that you're making a difference in what you're doing, innovation, skill sets over health insurance. So that totally falls in line with, you know, the shift that we see happening and totally ingrained within a future of work element. So that, I love that answer. And I think it's very much in line. Now,
have you heard of Polywork?
No, I have not.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's like the new LinkedIn for Gen Z and millennials.
Wow. All right. That's a great shout out to the listeners. I'm going to have to check that one out.
And it's invite only. So it's like they don't want, you know, they don't want who they don't want in there. And the idea behind it is, you know, exactly what you're saying. We will talk about the kind of work that we want to talk about in the place that we want to work with. So we're not going to have a recruiter reach out to us about a Fortune 5 company because it pays well. They're going to want to talk to us looking at our profile, knowing that we're interested in the kind of technology we're interested in. So
well, that's pretty amazing. Polywork is what you said?
Yeah, Polywork. I'll invite you.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm definitely going to check it out. Now, for the listeners out there, what's the easiest way that people can get in touch with Mike?
So with me personally or with my company?
Both.
Both. Okay. LinkedIn is probably, I'm now on Polywork as well. Mm-hmm. We're on Quora. And my name is Mike Yakin, but Technical Paradigm is the name of my company, technicalparadigm.com. We also host a Clubhouse room, if anyone's listening and is on Clubhouse, every Thursday at 7:30 CST, where we talk about the kind of topics we talked about today. So we'd love to have you guys.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Yeah. I've been a part of some of those Clubhouse sessions. So the go-to fintech agency, Technical Paradigm, especially establishing themselves within Chicagoland, and I'm sure everywhere else that fintech is involved in. Mike, thank you so much for your time today. It's been awesome interviewing you. Thank you for our listeners for tuning in and spending a few moments of their time with us today as well. We will catch you guys on the next Ivy Podcast episode. Thanks, everyone.
Angela, you're awesome. We'll talk soon.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.